The Church of God the Eternal presents What is the Natural Body? This is the number 22 tape of this series, and it will be given by Mr. Raymond Cole.
There is a body of sin, that is, with the various components or members of the body, like our hands and our feet and our eyes, our hearts, and so on. So there must also be, then, a body of righteousness. So we went through the generalization in this fact that there is a body of righteousness. And as a body of righteousness, it is a body under control. You know, our members, rather than being used for the purpose of practicing sin, or that which is contrary to the will of God, we use these members, including the mind and so on, for the purposes for which they were created. So, today we're going to talk about taste once again. It probably isn't going to be the most appealing by the time I get finished with it. But nonetheless, let's take a good look at it and see what it's all about. Because taste is indeed not only a physical function, because if you can't taste food, and we're going to read something about that later on, people who can't taste food find it to be very bland and they lose interest in it. It's taste itself, which actually is a mental function. You don't taste it in your mouth. Well, how should I say that? You do taste it in your mouth, but the concept of taste is in the mind. Just like the eye does not do the seeing. It only mirrors and takes in the image, but you see with the brain. Take the brain away and you don't see anything. So the brain interprets everything. The sense of feel is not with the fingers and so on. That only records the message and it's translated to the mind where it is interpreted and it tells you that it's hot or it's out here at the fingertip or wherever it is. But the brain does all the interpreting. You don't actually see in the sense of comprehension with the eye nor with hear with the ear. That's all done with the mind. It is only the physical function that occurs, that is, it either receives the message, it hears the message, or whatever, it is interpreted then by the mind. All right, taste is exactly the same way. So we take in certain foods and we can differentiate because the mind has all these things, these tastes cataloged. And the minute there's a certain type of taste that occurs, your mind says that's an onion or that's this or that's that or whatever it is, you know. The mind does all the interpreting. So taste, therefore, is the sixth of these members that I'm going to cover with regard to the body of righteousness. From the list, you know, of body members which I have listed to cover specifically. Now, obviously, since I'm going to cover about 9 or 10 of them, we're not covering every member of the body. There are many, many members of the body, but there are certain ones that God uses in rather specific, spectacular ways. Now, why did God give us the ability to taste? I guess he could have made it a lot of other ways, but he didn't. He made it so that we could actually taste and differentiate food, enjoy food, and so on. Can we rely, however, on the natural taste buds? To believe, as most people do, that we can rely on our natural taste is like saying, I can rely on the natural mind. Can you rely on the natural mind? No. The taste is no different than the mind or any other organ of the body. It must be trained. And especially those that have, or that is, that send signals to the brain and must be interpreted. So whether it's taste or whether it's hearing or whether it is seeing, all these things then are not to be trusted naturally. Do we trust what we hear? Do we trust what we taste? Do we trust what we see? Or do we take the time to reevaluate and to use the mind for significant reason? Now, is there a reason then above the physical for which control is necessitated? There must be something beyond just tasting physical food. And we're going to see that there are some very significant things mentioned in the Bible. Now, the reasons for which taste capacity, or for which taste capacity, rather, was created. Number one, let's see, because I have five or six of them written here, or six or seven, I don't remember the number until I get over there. It's to try concepts psychologically. You say, well, wait a minute, I thought taste was to taste food. I'm going to bring in the physical aspect of taste a little later because I have a reason for it. I want to start off now relating it to something far more significant than merely, tasting a piece of bread or fish or whatever it is. Something very significant and very meaningful about it. So, in this case, we want to start off then understanding its concepts psychologically. In Job, the sixth chapter, and let's note verse 30. Then I'm going to read just a very limited statement from a publication which we call TWOT, which is the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, but called, you know, in certain spheres, TWOT, T-W-O-T. So I'm going to read from that, but first I want to read from Job 6 here in verse 30. Is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? Now, to determine whether something is bad, indifferent, or good, do you use your taste buds? Well, not physically. However, now, if it is relating to the physical taste of something, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, you use the taste buds, don't you? So you also taste things psychologically. That is, you test it. And if it adds up, you know, or it tastes acceptably, then you either go ahead and eat it or digest it mentally, if that's what it is, or you eat it physically, whichever the case may be. I want to read now, since the word in the Hebrew is H-E-H. That's, you know, of course, an anglicized spelling in that, but I want to read now from TWOT, or a Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. H-E-H or H-E-K, however, you know, some will spell it one way and others will spell it another way, means the palate or the mouth. Half of the occurrences of H-E-K, as he writes it here, are in Job, where, rendered often as mouth, it is set in context of taste or speech. Theologically, the term is significant in two connections. As an organ vital for speech, like mouth, is linked with true and false statements. Linked with true and false statements, wisdom personified commends herself to mankind by saying, all the words of my mouth, or H-E-K, are righteousness. All the words of my mouth are gracious. They're sweet. They're benevolent. They are acceptable. They have a fine flavor. You hear frequently, do you not, the flavor of one's speech? Would have no meaning whatsoever if you didn't understand the significance of flavor physically. But it has a spiritual connotation. Job claims innocence because under provocation he has not permitted his mouth to sin. The expression tongue cleaveth to mouth, or cleaving to mouth, where it is used quite frequently, apart from denoting thirst, is an idiom in the Hebrew for being speechless. Ezekiel's dumbness may indicate the gravity of the impending destruction of Jerusalem, which meant that he literally, psychologically tasted of that devastation. He sensed it. He realized the seriousness, the gravity of the problem. Or perhaps the importance of waiting to speak God's word only. The idiom was used in imprecations and oaths. So now you will understand the word when we go through it. We're going to use it in a number of different ways today. We're talking about now the word H-E-K or H-E-H, depending on which one, which author is anglicizing it. In this context, now I want you to notice Job 12 and verse 11. Job 12 and verse 11. Doth not the ear try words, and the mouth taste its meat or his meat? So the ear tries words, and the mouth is the organ that basically receives the impulses with regard to flavor or taste, interpreted, as I said, of course, by the brain. So what we are talking about then in this context is the psychological significance of tasting. It is a form of experience, and it tells us that we have, you know, tasted of a certain way of life, a certain mannerism, a certain relationship, or whatever it may be. And we're going to see that usage in a number of ways a little later. Job 31 and verse 30. I'm merely establishing one set of circumstances here now, and that is that taste applies psychologically. Job 31, and noting verse 30. Neither have I suffered my mouth to sin by wishing a curse to his soul. Neither have I suffered my taste or mouth. Whatever, it's the same word. So it just simply means that which encompasses our ability to generate a concept. We conceive of certain things by those things which we put into our mouths. We put a dill pickle there, we know it's bitter. And we know it instantaneously. So psychologically, when certain things course our thinking, we know that they are bitter, adverse, or wrong, or whatever. And so Job said, neither have I allowed or suffered my mouth or this taste organ to sin by wishing a curse to another person's soul or body. In Job 33 now and verse 2, Job 33 and verse 2, behold, now I have opened my mouth. My tongue has spoken in my mouth. So he opened his mouth, but in opening his mouth, what he did was expressed that which he had tasted, experienced. You cannot go beyond what your experience is. If you have no grasp or knowledge of a particular thing, you can't say, well, yes, that's this or this or that or whatever. You can't say anything about it because you know nothing about it. But if you have tasted of it, physically or mentally, you're aware of something. There's a certain experience registered in your makeup or your thinking. And as the God's servant Job said, now I have opened my mouth, my tongue has spoken in my mouth. So he has spoken on the basis of his bitterness, his experience, or whatever. One other text very quickly now, and that's Psalms 119. Psalms 119 and verse 3. And here David writes, They also do no iniquity. They walk in his ways. I'm wondering, I must have the wrong text here, because it doesn't, although I know it's the right location, because he said now in verse 13, with my lips have I declared all the judgments of thy mouth. So it's probably verse 13 rather than 3 here. With my lips have I declared all the judgments of thy mouth. In other words, he had tasted of that way of life, and he had declared those things. What he had experienced or what he had tasted. Then in conclusion with that very concept, I want you to notice Canticles, which is a Song of Solomon. Canticles 2 and verse 3. As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, obviously, they're not eating one another. It was a joyful experience of great affection and regard for one another, because here is talking about the love of man and woman. And so he said, I sat down under his shadows with great delight. Here is the young maiden talking. And his fruit was sweet to my taste. Well, what was she doing? Eating his head? No, not at all. But it was a joyful experience. Pleasurable. Probably very scintillating conversation or whatever, and considered it a very rewarding experience. All right, so we see then that taste oftentimes denotes psychological experience, or the things that we taste from the mental perspective. Now, we asked the question up here initially, the reasons for which taste capacity was created so that we could differentiate. God has put many things into life. All foods have different flavors. You know, I assume that it would have been just as easy, maybe a lot easier, to have made a man with a single taste bud, or, you know, mankind with a single taste bud, so that there was never any differentiation. There was no variety of experience. It was all exactly the same thing. You could still live, but would there be any enjoyment and satisfaction out of it? It's the broad depth or the broad dimension of personal taste experience. And God gave us that capability, that potential. So that, you know, there are probably some foods that we like better than we do others. Now, that doesn't mean because we like one better than another that we should always take only the ones we like best. If you understand anything about nutrition, you'll certainly know that. Then what we should do is cultivate our minds to accept those things which are less favorable. And we eat them with purpose, because they are essential, or they're needful. Absolutely essential and needful, because God did not put everything the human body needs in 1, 2, 3, 4 different types of foods. He just didn't. But he did place them in a diverse fashion in many different foods, so that if we eat all types of foods, basically we're covering every front. Now, God then gave to us the capacity to differentiate the perverse from the genuine. But let's just think of it now for a moment. If we have not been intellectually trained, that is, if we have not had some standard of judgment that we have accepted as a basis of that judgment, how in the world could you ever differentiate? A child that comes into life does not have any perfectly developed system of taste. It acquires that taste. and usually on the basis of parental objections or prejudices. People who acquire certain dislikes for other people. Your child was not born with that dislike. It will be acquired because of the home in which it matures. If we dislike something else, we usually pass these things on to our children. And they're probably going to come up with the same dislikes or prejudices or whatever. We teach them. And children pick them up. Then we cannot possibly correctly differentiate food or other elements necessary for life also. Mental concepts, whether it's an apple or not. Even as the concept of Eve, you know, they view it as an apple, but I don't know whether it's a physical apple or not, but more particularly was the mental concept that was espoused, which forms the underlying or the undergirding principle of Babylonianism to this very day. And we're ultimately going to see its surface in its final trust to destroy the purpose of God. See, it started out with Eve. Well, it didn't start out with Eve, but she was the first one taught by Satan, who accepted it because it seemed so just and equitable and good. And we're going to see its last manifestation in the surfacing of Babylon in the last days. All right, physically, we can call it an apple if we want to. Whatever it was. I don't know if it was an apple or a fig or something else, because the Bible doesn't say. But nonetheless, we would never know unless we were trained and had a standard of judgment. So you cannot count on the taste buds to make that determination for you. Why is it then that one person, let's say in America here, will say of yogurt, ghastly, how does anybody ever eat that? And yet that's the rarest delicacy known to people in much of the East. Why, they'd rather have it than the stuff that you're eating any day of the week. And they'd probably think if you were to give them some of the things that you eat and say, how in the world could you ever put up with that? Then what is the difference? You mean you have different taste buds than they do? No. They're still physical taste buds. But you acquired certain mental outlook and responses to certain tastes, whereas they acquired theirs. Now, it doesn't make either one right or wrong. There still has to be a standard of judgment, of determination. So how are we going to know whether our taste buds are the ones to accept or theirs? Or maybe we shouldn't accept either one. So the taste buds have been given to us then for the distinct and the specific purpose of differentiation, so that we can determine the perverse from the genuine. I'll amplify on this concept as we go along. Here in Proverbs 5, Proverbs the 5th chapter, I'm going to read a number of verses here because I want us to I'm not sure what I'm going to do about the time element here. Do we have a clock or not? Or no clock today, so we'll go until I get tired. Here in Proverbs, the 5th chapter, specifically noticing verse 3, but I want to get it in context. So we're going to start in verse 1 and read through the entire principle here so that we can understand it. My son, attend unto my wisdom, and bow thine ear to my understanding, that thou mayest regard discretion, and that thy lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil. Here is the term mouth now, her mouth, meaning the palate, And it's, once again, this Hebrew word, H-E-K or H-E-H. What are we referring to here? Obviously, it is not just a physical woman in this sense. We're talking about a concept, religious concept, or a church orientation. For the lips of a strange woman drop as in honeycomb. That is, it sounds like it must be marvelous, very palatable and acceptable. Why? Because it is pleasing to the natural nature, the natural inclinations of our minds. That's why people subscribe to the various things. They subscribe to that which pleases them. Not that which is best, that which they want. That which tastes good to them. Doesn't make it right at all. And her mouth is smoother than oil. Comes out marvelously. Beautifully stated. Wrapped up in beautiful tinsel or package with bows and ribbons on it or whatever. But it doesn't make it right. Now notice. But her end is bitter as wormwood. Oftentimes, concepts that we accept, orientations in life, we pursue them, and then the end result is devastating. Have you ever had that to happen to you? Sharp as a two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. And takes terrible advantage. Her feet go down to death. Tasted not marvelous. Drops as a honeycomb. Smoother than oil. But how devastating. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold on hell. Lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life. Her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them. So here now is a concept. We're not talking about an individual in this sense whatsoever, but that which represents a philosophy, a way. And it may sound so pleasing and so acceptable, so palatable, and yet look at its devastating consequence. Hear me now, therefore, O you children, and depart not from the words of my mouth. So God says now, even though this was so palatable and so acceptable, no, he said, don't depart from my way, my words. Now, what did God say about his way? I won't take time to read all the texts, but you know them as well as I do, when he said that we don't like it. They're not a bit pleasing, nor palatable, nor acceptable to us. Man hates and has a contemptuous attitude toward the truth of God, God's way of life. He doesn't like it. In other words, his taste rejects it. But is it good? Indeed it is. It's the way of life, abundant life, health and happiness and everything that is acceptable and pleasing. And yet here now is a way that is like a honeycomb. And yet the consequences are tragic. Remove thy way far from her. This is a conceptual idea now. We're not talking about an individual at all. And come not nigh to the door of her house. That is, don't let it have entrance into your thinking or your way of life. Lest thou give thine honor unto others and thy years unto the cruel. Because God said if you pursue it, even though it's very tasty, even though it seems to be so marvelous and so smooth and so acceptable, yet it will rob you of honor, it will rob you of integrity, it will rob you of longevity, it will rob you of everything you have ever wanted. Just pursue it. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, that is, others will take advantage. And thy labors be in the house of a stranger. It will take initiative, orientation, direction, and purpose from you. And they'll wind up in the house of someone else. And thou mourn at the last, when thy flesh and thy body are consumed. The ultimate end. And we look back and say, why? For what reason? A life of futility, reaping no advantages whatsoever. And say, how have I hated instruction? And my heart despised reproof, and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined thine ear to them that instructed me. I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. Now here now is a play on the taste as a way that seems to be so palatable and so acceptable. And it would appear on the basis of the natural inclinations, the natural taste, that it was superb and marvelous, and yet it's going to reap the bitter, tragic end. Whereas there is another way, abhorred, spurned, and rejected, that has within it all the elements of eternity, beneficence, greatness, and all that is good. Then how are we going to determine? Can it be by accepting our natural inclinations? The answer is no. So the natural taste cannot orient us. It cannot give us the direction, as the mind itself, which experiences the various circumstances of life, cannot give us that direction. The standard of judgment must come from outside. Proverbs 8 now. Proverbs 8 and verse 7, but let's read verses 5 through 7. Proverbs 8 and beginning in verse 5. O you simple, understand wisdom, and you fools, be you of an understanding heart. Solomon is writing to humanity. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Here the word mouth is H-E-H or H-E-K, whichever. Or that member of the body which interprets experience. For my palate, whether it now be in the psychological sense of the mind, or whether it be the physical member of this body that tastes the various substances ingested. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Meaning simply that as we go through life's experiences, there is one inevitable conclusion. We will come to recognize that there is only one way that produces beneficence and all the good abundance that we have wanted. If we have not yet come to that point, it simply means that there is enough perversity within our taste, we are not yet capable of exercising the basic responsibility of that organ. My mouth shall speak truth. Meaning, as we have gone through our experiences, and we have carefully analyzed those experiences, and we recognize the consequences of mistakes because we see them written in the whole course of our life. Lives that have lived a way that has become strewn with discarded concepts because they didn't pay any dividends. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. When the experience has been full, complete, that's exactly where we will come. If we have not yet reached that level of comprehension, understanding, it means there are yet experiences to be experienced. And they will come. Because we will in time learn that only those things which are right pay dividends. Then will our lips speak truth and righteousness. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing froward or perverse in them. They are all plain to him that understands, and right to them that find knowledge acquired through a life of experience. Receive my instruction, and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold, of how much greater value is that kind of experience than all the precious metals and stones on the face of this earth. Proverbs 24 and verse 13. Proverbs 24, noticing verse 13. My son, eat thou honey, because it is good, and the honeycomb, which is sweet to thy taste. So here now is the matter of literally tasting a physical substance. And honey, I think, without doubt, is the sweetest substance known. It's the most intense sugar that exists. So shall the knowledge of wisdom, that is in comparable fashion, so shall the knowledge of wisdom be unto thy soul. When thou hast found it, then there shall be a reward, and thy expectation shall not be cut off. You know, when you think of that, whatever it is, elixir that you take, whether it's an eye-opener in the morning, and I'm certainly not suggesting this, but most seem to subscribe to it regardless. You have to have, or most people say, I can't get going until I have that first cup of coffee. And so they have to have that elixir in the morning. But when you think about it, if that is the very substance that gives you the kick, and that's the reason you partake of it, after all, it does have a kick to it. And it wakes up the various components of the body, and gets you on the high and you're ready to go and so on. Well, it's for the same reason people take drugs, because caffeine is a drug. There isn't any question about it. It just isn't as potent as some other drugs. But anyway, when you think about that, the mouth waters, doesn't it? Or if it's something else that you gloriously anticipate, your mouth waters. Or maybe that expression got started and doesn't have any basis. Mouth watering, delicious, never heard of it. Or when you think about something, does the mouth water? That saliva gets up and really goes, doesn't it? And you're ready to partake of it. But then imagine what happens if you put it in your mouth and it's as bitter as gall. What a disillusionment. All right, he's capitalizing on that very experience. And basically, truths are predicated on certain basic concepts. I don't care whether they're spiritual or physical in nature. And thy expectation shall not be cut off. In other words, where we're gloriously anticipating something, if it is acceptable and right in God's sight, it's not going to be cut off. It isn't going to be like wormwood or as bitter as gall or whatever. Your expectation shall not be cut off. Lay not wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Spoil not his resting place. For a just man falleth seven times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth. We'll pick up the remainder of the concept here momentarily. Lest the Lord see it, and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. Fret not thyself because of evil men, neither be thou envious at the wicked. For there shall be no reward to the evil man. What God is saying is that even though all people want to go a certain way, don't fret about these things. We can never learn that lesson. And don't then orient your life and your expectation on the basis of what every other human being is doing. Because he said there isn't going to be any reward for them, or in some cases it may be cut off. The candle of the wicked shall be put out. My son, fret not the Lord, fear thou the Lord and the king, and meddle not with them that are given to change. For their calamity shall rise suddenly, and who knows the ruin of them both. So let's not then let these circumstances, whatever one else is doing, let's not let those circumstances sway us. There is a standard of judgment, and God said, use that standard and make your decisions accordingly. All right, then the next principle is, with regard to the taste, it is to gain experience in a general usage. The other was to differentiate between the perverse and the genuine. And the only way we can do that is, as we said, by having a standard. How would you know? Now, we all know in this world that there are certain things that you just cannot partake of. You wouldn't think of doing it because they're lethal. They're poisonous. To give you one example, how many of you, and I'm sure there must be some, that thoroughly enjoy rhubarb, don't you? But did you know there are certain parts of that rhubarb plant you better leave alone? If you don't, you won't be among the living. Now, since we know that, we don't bother with it, do we? But I might give you another illustration. Many of us like, nightshade products, don't we? Now, put it in those terms, we probably are asking what the world is nightshade product. Well, your potato and your tomato and a number of others, I won't go into all of them, are all nightshade products. But let me assure you that there are some nightshade substances you'd better not eat. Not if you want to stay among the living. Some have tried at various times and they paid the price, because they are very quick acting. They take their toll right now. They don't wait around. Other things are doing injustice, or they are doing lethal things to us, but they just take a lot longer to achieve it, to accomplish that objective or that end. And so we are in many ways paying a price that we need not pay if we only understood. But the same thing is true psychologically. There are some concepts, if we were to carry them out, would be instantaneous or immediate death. That's what precipitates suicides. They wind up dead. There are others that don't take their toll so dramatically. It takes much longer. But it is called, nonetheless, the way of death. Now, in this case, in a generalized sense, it means to gain experience. We taste of certain things. And by that, we know that certain things pay off and certain things don't. We don't want to have anything to do with it. I'm going to a Greek word initially. Over here in Hebrews 2 and verse 9. Hebrews 2 and noting verse 9. And this word is G-U-O-M-A-I. It's the Greek word for taste. Let's notice it here in Hebrews 2 and verse 9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. That is the ultimate lethality. That's the extinction of life. Christ has paid for that price so that you and I do not have to, providing we can accept that in faith. But he tasted of that as an experience. He tasted death for every man. If we ever have to go through it, this same experience that Christ did, there isn't any chance for us. There's no way that we can go through it and experience it. He tasted for every man. For if we ever taste our own, that's ultimate. There's no way of it. It's final, it's complete. So it is then a matter of generalized experience. Christ tasted then of that ultimate death, that now by the indwelling presence of Christ, through the mind of Christ and his life being lived within us, we can vicariously experience those same things that Christ did. In Jeremiah now, 48 and verse 11. Jeremiah 48. And noting verse 11. Here Jeremiah was inspired to write, Moab hath been at ease from his youth, and he hath settled on his lees, and hath not been emptied from vessel to vessel. Neither hath he gone into captivity. Therefore his taste remained in him, and his scent is not changed. I don't want to go through a long explanation of what he's talking about here. You can read it. But I merely want you to understand that what he's talking about is that Moab never experienced certain things. Therefore, he has no grasp of what's gone on. He's not gone into captivity. This has not happened and that has not happened. So he is saying then that Moab was not in the position to comprehend nor to understand, because he, even in a vicarious sense, had not experienced the adversity of captivity and the other problems to which Israel had been subjected. That's what he is saying there. All right, then I want us to notice now, by going back to the New Testament once again, that incidentally was a Hebrew word, and that Hebrew word there is tagam, T-A-H-G-A-M. All right, now let's turn to Matthew 16. Matthew, the 16th chapter and verse 28. Verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. So it is then, you know, even in death, it's a taste of something. It's an experience. In some cases, it's an experience that is going to be overcome by a miraculous intervention on the part of God. In other cases, it is an experience that will be eternal. there'll be no recovery from it. But in this case, we are simply talking about a generalized taste or experience. In Mark 9:1 and in Luke 9 and verse 27, you will find the same usage. I'll not take time to refer to those texts. But next I want us to note then Matthew 27 and verse 34. Matthew 27 and noting verse 34. They gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. See, the taste there was, the minute he had tasted it, then his brain told him what it was. And he refused to have anything to do with it. So it was simply a matter, in this case, of a physical taste that registered in the mind, and then Christ refused it. So we are talking about the actual knowledge gained by the mind through that taste experience. And because of this experience, then Christ recognized this, and he knew the reason for which he was given, and he refused to have any part to do with it. All right, I am not going to proceed because I rather suspect we must be about at that time, as I don't have a clock down here this time. So I'm going to just wait, and I'll finish this up, the last three of those principles, the next time. And I am going to cover the, I'll just mention to you that it is an experience. I gave it to you in a general sense. It means a very broad and comprehensive, but now we want to get into specific areas. So it is a taste that differentiates things specifically. And we will deal with that, and then we're going to deal with it as a matter of a manifestation of purpose, orientation, or will. And then I'm going to relate it right back to the actual physical taste itself and show how it applies. So we'll go through that, and then following that, we're going to pick up the next one that relates directly to that, and that's the tongue. And how the tongue relates to the taste, and when we put it all together, then we'll see how the entire mouth then forms that area in which there is a great deal of experience translated into the brain that gives us direction and orientation. More of it then coming later on.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented What is the Natural Body? This was the number 22 tape in this series, and it was given by Mr. Raymond Cole.